Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. And we've got the cases here. Let's see, we've got one, two, three, four, three this morning. And we've got one, two, three, four this afternoon. So we will proceed, and I'll ask the clerk to call the docket.
May it please the court. Good morning.
All right. Ready? Go.
Morning.
Morning.
This is the case of Patel versus the City of Everman. There were 6 points raised on this appeal. And just briefly, this case involves five buildings that was owned by Patel that were subject to a demolition order by the City of Everman. 15 of the buildings, there were a total of 20, 15 were disposed of by the Tyler Court of Appeals on a previous motion for summary judgment. So we're here today concerning five of the buildings. There's a lot of procedural issues as to those five, but it suffices to say that there's five of them. There's an important point about Texas landowners' rights. The right to be compensated for a takings of property is recognized in the Texas Constitution as well as the United States Constitution. It's recognized under the United States is recognized under the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause, and it is there to accommodate Texas landowners or state landowners that do not have an adequate compensation system under their own constitutions. But it's my position that Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution does provide an adequate compensation system, which is a 10-year statute of limitations for a landowner to complain about a city's decision to demolish buildings, with the right to a jury trial and with the burden of proof placed on the municipality to prove that the buildings in question were a public nuisance. If they cannot prove that, then they must compensate the landowner. However, prior to jumping into the full legal discussion about landowners' rights and what the effect of the city's argument may be and whether it applies, this Chapter 214 of the Local Government Code, I did want to address briefly a procedural issue that applies to summary judgments, and that is the movement, which in this case was the City of Everman, must attach to their motion for summary judgment the evidence upon which they rely and the evidence upon which they ask the court to rely to grant the motion for summary judgment. And in this case, there was no evidence attached to the second motion for summary judgment, which was filed after the Tyler Court of Appeals opinion. This case is about 10 years old. There's a lot of history here, but there was two motions for summary judgment, an original and a first amended, filed before the Tyler Court of Appeals decision. And there was lengthy evidence attached to those. In fact, the summary judgment record in this case of the previous appendices to the previous motions, it takes up like three volumes of what y'all are looking at. But the appendix to the motion for summary judgment before this court has no volumes, not even one page. So the Court of Appeals will be asked to make a decision on whether a movement's failure to attach evidence to the motion is fatal to the motion. And that
wasn't it incorporated by reference, though?
Well, that is the issue, is exactly what did they do? The city repeatedly referenced evidence in the form of C appendix attached here too, because I believe that they believed that the appendix was attached to the second motion for summary judgment. However, after filing a designation of record and three motions for extension of time to file my brief so I could get the appendix, it was finally produced by the clerk in a supplemental record CR1, page 201, no appendix in the record. And my designation of the record was found at the 10th volume of the clerk's record, 2018, number 6, which asks, please provide all exhibits to all motions for summary judgment. So it hasn't been waived. As to the specific question, was it incorporated by reference? There's various cases that try to answer if the movement is referencing evidence, how must they reference it to suffice if it's not attached to the motion? And the case law, as I see it, there must be a specific reference to the evidence in question, and there must be a citation evidence. And in this case, with the appendix as large as it was, the Court of Appeals is going to have to go backwards, as it did in Tackett versus White, which is the last case I've seen from this court on this issue, and look in the record to see where it is and exactly what did the movement do to reference it. And in Tackett versus White, all they were asked to do was to look at a 9-page deposition transcript of the non-movement's evidence. And the majority held in that case that the movement had adequately referenced the non-movement's evidence. See, that 9-page deposition excerpt was not in the movement's appendix. It was in the non-movement's appendix. And Justice Casey, the majority, held that that was a sufficient reference. In this case, and by the way, there was a dissent in that case, but in this case, the court is going to have to reference literally hundreds of pages because the city is relying on Chapter 214 of the Local Government Code. Well, in this new defense that they're saying was not addressed by the Tyler Court of Appeals. And to do so, they must produce the city ordinance of Everman. They must show that the city of ordinance specifically adopted the Chapter 214 Local Government Code. There must be evidence of public hearings on the matter held by the city of Everman. There must be evidence of the substandard notices placed on the Patel's buildings an adequate time period before the city held the hearings. There must be evidence that the buildings in question were a public nuisance. There must be evidence of the city council's decision to demolish the buildings. That's why this must be hundreds of pages, and that's, in fact, what there was in the previous motions. So because of the procedural position we're in today, the Court of Appeals is going to be asked to go through each legal point to see if, in fact, the city adequately, when they say see appendix, what part of the appendix and how does it apply to the previous motion for summary judgment that was filed 4 years earlier? So I think that this is going to be the broadest request in our jurisprudence of a court of appeals to go and to the aid of a movement that hasn't attached the motion, that hasn't attached the evidence. It's the broadest request I've seen. It's much broader than the 9-page deposition excerpt from Tackett versus Wyatt. Now, on to, if there's no further, well, let me go ahead and address a few additional arguments on this particular point. Does the appellant waive his objection if he doesn't object to the fact that there's no evidence attached to the motion for summary judgment? That would be a substantive defect in the motion for summary judgment. The non-movement is only required to object to procedural defects in the motion for summary judgment, such as if the movement is relying on hearsay evidence or there's a defect in the affidavits, but not if there's no evidence. There is one case that from El Paso that they did cite, Colorum. However, and this one literally did come close to saying that, which was surprising. However, in Colorum, they covered, in my opinion, the court covered itself by saying the evidence at issue that was not attached was actually attached to a third motion for summary judgment filed before the court entered a decision. And so I think that that removes the waiver argument totally from that case, because there actually was a subsequent motion for summary judgment that they relied on that had the evidence at issue. As to the...
Doesn't that cut against your argument that they can't go back and consider a previous evidence attached to the previous motion?
The Colorom case?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, because the Colorom case was actually the last motion for summary judgment on file before the court entered its decision. And the law states that subsequent motions supersede previous ones, and that's why there's a problem in this case, because the actual last motion that the court considered didn't have any evidence attached to it.
Okay.
Now, the other argument is that I've addressed that already. I did ask for this evidence. Therefore, I will move to the issue of landowners' rights in the state of Texas. If the court is to hold, from a procedural standpoint, that there was a way to explain the lack of evidence and that they had relied on the previous motion or the non-movement's motion and is able to get through that, then we address the substance of the argument. I'm not addressing right now whether the Tyler Court of Appeals is the law of the case. I would like for the court to consider that argument. I just don't have enough time. Landowners' rights. Chapter 214 does not specifically mention takings claims. And that's a problem because the court is going to be asked to do statutory construction in this case to determine whether takings claims were considered to be part of this statute. It's a concern because, like I had said, I believe that in the state of Texas we have an adequate system to compensate landowners, a 10-year statute of limitations. Chapter 214 would reduce that to 30 days. Chapter 214 would reduce a landowner's right to judicial review to an appeal to a district court for a hearing, and I equate the word a hearing to one hearing, under the substantial evidence rule. And the substantial evidence rule has been explained as if there is any evidence to support the city's decision to demolish the buildings and to find the buildings to be a public nuisance, then it must be upheld, which would abrogate the previous law, which stated that the burden would be on the city in a district court to prove a public nuisance. And so because it's missing, we have to look at the practical application of the law as well as the statutory, the legislative history of that law. Because if we go to the plain meaning of the law, which is what ordinarily we can do, there is no discussion of takings claims, and so we can't do that. So we look at the practical application of this as well as the legislative history. As to the practical application, trial judges will be left with a particular issue, and that is whether they can grant injunctive relief or not. Okay, if Chapter 214 provides a hearing under the substantial evidence rule, then does that mean the temporary injunction hearing is that hearing? And if so, you know, normal injunction law says that if the city can prove a probability of success, then you go ahead and, well, if the party against whom the injunctive relief is sought can prove a probability of success, then you don't deny the injunction. In this case, is there going to be any injunctive relief? Because there's only entitlement to one hearing. Second, is the takings claim ripe? If it has to be filed within 30 days of the city's hearing, then how is a takings claim going to be ripe for review at the time the appeal is made? So what you'd be expected to do is amend your pleadings, I suppose, after the city has demolished the buildings and after the 30 days has expired, because what you're appealing is the city's decision to demolish. You're not making a takings claim when you're appealing originally. Because according to the law, the city, the court can reverse the city's decision. Well, then when exactly do you make your takings claim, and in what hearing do you make it? Because if the court has already decided that they're going to reverse, then, you know, if the city goes ahead and ignores the order, then do you have a takings claim at that point? And then is it under the substantial evidence rule? What I'm saying is this legislation is poorly drafted, and there's no discussion in the legislative history of takings claims. And there was legislative history attached to the city's brief, and I would ask the court to look at that legislative history because it's not in there. It discusses how the 30 days makes it where the city doesn't have to wait a long time to know if they have the right to knock the buildings down. Well, my position on that is, yeah, they want to be able to... Okay, the red light went off.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dofano. All right, Mr. Quast.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Fritz Quast, of course, here on behalf of the City of Everman. I'm going to very briefly discuss the summary judgment evidence issue. Essentially, summary judgment evidence does not need to be attached physically to the motion for summary judgment. The only time the word attached is used in Rule 166 is when it discusses that if an affidavit references an exhibit, then the exhibit needs to be attached to the affidavit. As a matter of fact, the cases that he's citing about substantive defects, those are cases concerning when you have an affidavit that an exhibit referenced in the affidavit is not attached. Not here. The only thing that Rule 166A says is that the summary judgment evidence needs to be on file at the time of the hearing. And also, the motion needs to specifically reference the summary judgment evidence. In this case, I will plead, I don't know what happened. I remember being in the copy room, and I thought that the appendix was filed. But the motion itself specifically references and says, specifically, this motion, attached to this motion, is an appendix. It is identical to the appendix that was attached to the first motion for summary judgment. Now, it's been brought up that, you know, these were huge appendices, that, you know, there wasn't any specific references. Well, if you look at the city's second motion for summary judgment, it contains specific references to page numbers. All of these appendices, were consecutively paginated. The first appendix and the first amended appendix were essentially identical, except the second or first amended appendix added a couple of exhibits. So all of the specific page references in the city's second motion for summary judgment specifically refer to and match up with the page numbers found on both of the prior exhibits. So specific reference to evidence is not a problem. It's been raised that we have to have all this evidence to prove collateral estoppel or res judicata. I don't think that's necessarily true, even though I referenced a bunch of evidence. The only evidence that needs to be attached or needed to be referenced or is relevant to this motion were the prior orders of the board for the 20 buildings, or the 5 buildings, excuse me, that are left, and Mr. Patel's notice of nonsuit of the prior appeal. Anything else is not really relevant. Now, with respect to the law of the case doctrine, the court just needs to reference Laura Maintenance of Way Incorporated v. Iani. It's 210 Southwest 3rd, 593. Essentially, regardless of what happened at the Court of Appeals, when parties take an appeal to the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals is no longer the court of last resort. That's what happened in this case. Both Patel and the city filed cross petitions for review. Those petitions were ultimately denied. And again, the denial of a petition for review is not a substantive ruling on anything. It is not the law of the case. And lastly, I'm going to address what is probably the central issue in this case, or the most important issue in this case, is point three. And in that point, Patel contends that, you know, the board's order shouldn't collaterally stop a subsequent takings claim because Chapter 214 does not apply to a takings claim. Appellant points out that Chapter 214 and the judicial review provisions in that chapter don't mention takings claims, and that is absolutely correct. There's not a breath, there's not a word, there's not a sentence in there on how to treat takings claims. Appellant says that the judicial review provision only provides for reversal, modification, or affirming of the order. That's absolutely true also. There's no provision in there for a property owner to seek compensation under those appeal procedures, but that's never been the city's argument. It's never been our argument that a takings claim is absolutely precluded by these judicial review proceedings. It is our contention, and it's always been our argument, is that if you want to bring a subsequent takings claim, you have to first see that the board's orders are reversed.
So a board's order, under your position, allowing demolition of a building,
yes,
is necessarily a determination by the board or municipality that the building is a public nuisance.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, as long as it is not appealed.
Okay.
As long as it is not appealed.
Well, does it say that? Does the ordinance say that, or does the local government code say that?
No,
I can't find that language in the ordinance or the code. It talks about dilapidated buildings, substandard buildings.
That is correct. However, if you look at the orders, most times the orders will find will have language in them that specifically says that the board finds that these buildings are a threat to health and public safety, which is, I mean, that is the per se definition of what a nuisance is. If we have a takings claim under these circumstances, the plaintiff's elements of the inverse condemnation claim are never really an issue. Okay, the elements are intent, damage, public purpose. If the city goes onto property and bulldozes buildings, then those things really aren't an issue. What is at issue in an inverse condemnation claim under these circumstances is, you know, the city's affirmative defense, which usually would be, you know, can the city demolish the buildings without having to pay compensation because the buildings amount to a nuisance, or in other words, they're a threat to health, public safety, and welfare. This finding, what would be at issue in a subsequent takings claim, that is the heart and soul and essence of these substandard building orders. The board's orders are not immune to a subsequent takings claim, then the board's orders are essentially worthless. The hearings that are provided for in the statute are a waste of time. The appeal to the district court is a colossal waste of time. The orders themselves are meaningless and useless and worthless. Hypothetically speaking, you know, what happens if a city gets a demolition order and it is either not appealed, it is appealed, but as in this case, the appeal is dismissed, or what if the order is affirmed by the district court? And a city official comes to the city attorney and says, "The attorney, what can we do?" And under what the law is, clearly, or should be, is that yes, we have these orders. They have the force and effect of law. We can go forward and demolish these buildings. Under appellant's view of the law, the answer has to be yes, but. yes, we can demolish the buildings, but then we have to hope and pray for 10 years that we don't get sued for a taking. And by the way, in that subsequent lawsuit, the main issue is going to be the condition of the buildings. All right, those buildings that we're going to demolish and cart off and carry away in trucks. So it doesn't really make any sense that you can bring a subsequent takings claim after the board's orders are final. Now, I will admit that this is a very harsh result for Mr. Patel. He non-suited his appeal, and our position is that essentially wiped out his takings claim because at that point the board's orders were final. And I'll admit that he has a valuable property right, a property right that's constitutionally protected. But as I understand the facts in this case, he wanted to give up. I mean, after the buildings were down, he didn't see the reason for proceeding. So he went and focused on bringing a federal claim or federal lawsuit in federal court. Although I admit that this is a bad result for Mr. Patel, I think that there are a couple of things that he could have done differently. Instead of non-suiting the appeal, he should have just kept the appeal going. And had he reversed those orders, he would have been entitled to bring a takings claim at any time within the statute of limitations after the demolition took place. But reversal of the board's orders is an essential prerequisite to being able to bring that takings claim. Probably more procedurally efficiently, like was suggested, he could have just added a takings claim to the already pending petition for writ of certiorari case pending in the district court. And then...
But as he says, it would have been premature at that time.
Well, once the city... The statute clearly provides, or doesn't clearly provide, it makes it clear that filing of the appeal doesn't stay proceedings. So the city is given the authority to, during the pendency of the appeal, even though it can be risky, to go ahead and demolish the buildings. I'm sorry, what was your question again? I totally lost
it. It was just a comment. I don't guess it was a real question. Oh, he couldn't add the takings claim, I think that's what I was trying to say, at the time he appealed the board's ruling because it hadn't been destroyed yet and therefore a takings claim is premature.
Once the buildings are knocked down, he can add a takings claim to the already pending case. At that time, the case will have ripened.
So there's no way he can stop the city from going forward and demolishing the buildings?
Absolutely, there is. I mean, there is some legislative history that it's a bill analysis, and, you know, I'm the one that originally quoted this bill analysis because it has really good stuff in it. But one of the things it says is that this precludes the trial court from issuing injunctive relief, and I don't think that is true at all. The statute says that the filing of the petition does not stay the proceedings, okay? I think that leaves open the possibility that the appellant could go, as Patel did in this case, and request from the trial court a temporary injunction halting the demolition during the pendency of the appeal before the district court. He complains that, you know, what happens after that? What if I'm denied injunctive relief? Well, if you're denied injunctive relief, you're denied a temporary injunction, that's subject to an interlocutory appeal. And when you appeal that interlocutorily, you can petition the Court of Appeals for a writ of injunction staying the demolition during the pendency of the appeal before the Court of Appeals. And that's specifically what happened in N. Ray Teague. It's an opinion. It's an original proceeding by Justice Livingston, 2006 Westlaw 302123. The underlying appeal in that case is City of Jacksboro, or Teague versus City of Jacksboro, I'm sorry. But that's precisely what happened. There was an appeal of the temporary injunction denial, and then the Court of Appeals stepped in and said, don't demolish yet. That's another thing that Mr. Patel could have done in this case. Having said all that, if the court finds or sees fit to go ahead and affirm, I would ask that the court set out these procedures and give warning to landowners that they don't need to just ignore these orders. I mean, a lot of times cities have the problem where lay people think that just because these people aren't wearing black robes or sitting downtown or down in Austin that their decisions don't have any legal weight or effect, and that's absolutely not the case. Unless the court has any questions, I'll rely on my briefing for the remainder of the points.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Quast.
Thank you.
Mr. Nofino, you have 5 minutes.
What I was going to say is that just the nuts and bolts of trying to determine whether a statute or code provision applies to a certain situation is to read the plain language and see if there's anything in there addressing the issue at hand. Second is the legislative history, and three is the practical consequences of particular constructions. And that's all I was trying to bring up to the court, because it's my contention that the parties were confused, even in this case, as to whether this statute applies or not. The statute was raised for the first time in a motion for rehearing at the Tyler Court of Appeals years after the buildings were demolished. And so Judge Sutterith, when she was holding the injunction hearing, was never even informed of this code provision and wasn't aware of whether she should apply the substantial evidence rule or not. Does it apply? And does injunctive relief, is that permitted under the Chapter 214? The case by Justice Livingston, the issue in that case in 2006 was a petition for a restraining order and a temporary injunction adequate under the Chapter 214 to constitute an appeal? And she did say yes, that it was. Now, the argument wasn't raised in that case of exactly the way it is here, of the substantial evidence rule, and can an injunction hearing be held? And if it is held, again, is that the only hearing that the landowner gets? Because that's a hearing. And so the argument could be made that the hearing that Judge Sutterith held back in 1999, that was the hearing. That was it. And when she decided not to allow the buildings to be knocked down, that was Patel's appeal. And when he non-suited 6 months later, he wasn't really non-suiting anything, because that was it. That was the whole ballgame. What was he supposed to litigate at the second hearing in front of Judge Sutterith? The statute doesn't address it. Judge Sutterith might have had a full trial on it, because she didn't know about Chapter 214. I don't know. But now that it's being brought up at this hour, it has to be answered. And it's a very interesting question. Under the statute, what was Judge Sutterith supposed to hear after that initial temporary injunction hearing was denied? Was she supposed to have a full trial on it? Was she supposed to have a jury trial? Was she allowed to collect new evidence? Because this statute says that, you know, you're not supposed to have new evidence. It's just a limited hearing under the substantial evidence rule, where you don't even really look at the landowner's evidence. You look at the city's evidence and see if there's any evidence to support it. So if this is in fact the law, then, and you have, and I've cited facts in here where it looked like Patel was treated very unfairly by the city. It wasn't that he was blowing things off. He was being treated unfairly. And there will be landowners in the future that, for whatever reason, cities do that to. And so their right to judicial review is, and the landowners' rights, I know in the state of Texas, is sacredly held. And so I do believe that this is one of the very important opinion to be issued by this court. With that, I will...
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dofino. Mr. Quast, we appreciate your arguments. They have been helpful, and you will hear from the court. Thank you. You're dismissed.